KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
The struggle. Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn says the city's memorandum of understanding with Hanson is for 5 years, and officials will continue working to bring the NBA back to Seattle. The city of Seattle has offered before to collect your old guns. Now King County wants to set up a system to take your old medications off your hands. The County Board of Health is rolling out a proposal for a drug take-back system today in response to new guidelines from the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration. The DEA and the Health Board say a drug take-back system is needed because of rises in abuse, poisonings, and deaths from household medications, prescription and over-the-counter. They're hazardous waste, so they should not be flushed, and even throwing them out can taint the water supply. The proposal calls for pharmacies to volunteer to be drop-off sites. The county would make sure the drugs were incinerated. The drug companies would pay for it. Washington state legislators have proposed a statewide system before. Drug companies opposed it. They said they were waiting for the new guidelines from the DEA. The county says 24 local pharmacies already offer to take back old medications. Police departments have participated in one-day take-backs coordinated by the DEA, including one last month. But those will end under the new federal guidelines. This is KUOW News. I'm Jamala Henderson.
It's 56 degrees in Seattle. The forecast says we should reach 66 this afternoon. We're looking at clouds through the morning, then partly sunny sky this afternoon with a continuing chance of showers through the day. Support for NPR comes from IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines.
Support for KUOW comes from Propel Insurance.
It's 9:06. I'm Bernard Ouellette. KUOW is a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Metro bus cuts loom unless state lawmakers extend taxing authority to King County. That's a warning from Metro and King County exec Dow Constantine. He'll be joining us next hour to talk about buses and basketball. And speaking of basketball, it wasn't really a surprise, but yesterday the NBA Board of Governors voted 22-8 to keep the Sacramento Kings the Sacramento Kings. Art Thiel, editor of Sports Press Northwest, joins us now. Hi, Art.
Greetings.
Anything surprise you about what happened yesterday?
Well, I think the relocation issue was foreordained 2 weeks earlier by a committee that allegedly voted 7-0 to keep the Kings in Sacramento. I think the surprise was that nothing else came toward Seattle in this. There was speculation before the vote that there would be an effort by the owners to try to make a commitment to Hanson and his partner Steve Ballmer to expansion at some point. And that did not materialize yet. Not to say that they couldn't, because what's happening is that Hanson is still hanging tough. As your news report had, he wants to be a 20% partner of the Maloofs as they continue to operate the team and not sell it to the group led by Silicon Valley billionaire Vivek Ranadive in Sacramento. And if he could do that, he would be in the owner's club. Mm-hmm. And in a much better position for Seattle's future than being an outsider. So I don't give that very much of a chance, because the NBA owners can say who can join the club and who can't.
Yeah, I find actually the whole politics of this as fascinating as I find any outcome. One of the things that was interesting, and I don't know if you watched the Stern news conference, Stern Silver news conference, I guess it was, afterwards, but Stern looked so kind of weary, and it got me to wondering what role he had played in all of this.
Big. He has looked weary, and there are people who've been around him who say there's a reason he's retiring. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. he's 70 and he's tired.
Yeah.
And, so the issue is what his political role in this is, and I think it was very strong. He did not basically want to go through with Sacramento what he went through in Seattle in 2008. Ironic, isn't it?
Yes.
We wound up putting our own hand around our civic throat again here, because Hansen had a very good deal, way more than what Sacramento was offering. But as Stern put it, the power of incumbency prevailed in roughly equal offers. Well, they weren't roughly equal, and Stern's going to find that out when they try to put that arena deal together, which is really all balsa wood and duct tape right now.
Well, but I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that was his choice to make.
One of the things I was wondering in this, everything being equal and incumbency, was the brouhaha that we've heard in media outside of Seattle and some inside of Seattle that in particular people meaning owners, were turned off by Steve Ballmer and Chris Hansen throwing money around and throwing weight around and not enough sort of civic public officials throwing their weight around, i.e. we didn't get enough commitment from the city and it was all about, you know, a couple of guys with money.
Well, if you look at every single NBA owner, they throw money around recklessly and ruthlessly. It would be very difficult and highly hypocritical for any owner to say that Hansen and Ballmer were jerks in this. this is the club of jerks. So, and the other irony in that one is that Ballmer was done in by a monopoly, and some have said that Microsoft is a monopoly. So, but ironies aside, the behavior and attitude wasn't a big deal, I don't think. Stern said that, and that was one of the few things in that press conference I believed. But what was a big deal, I think, is the Hansen's continued association with the Maloofs, the family that owns the Kings, which they found untidy, because the NBA wants to not only keep the Kings in Sacramento, they want to get rid of the Maloofs. And as long as Hansen is tethered to the Maloofs by that purchase and sale and this subsequent deal to own 20%, they can't get rid of the Maloofs, exactly. But there is a small chance, and I would say it's small, that if the Hansen-Ballmer group were to untether from the Maloofs, they might be able to consider an expansion commitment for 2014-2015. Nothing's going to happen for this fall, and that's what Hansen wanted. And Hansen's urgency is legitimate, because he's afraid that with the mayoral election and the loss of enthusiasm by fans after this second rejection in 5 years by the NBA, that he won't be able to sustain the project.
Speaking of fans, we've got some comments from our listeners on our Facebook page. Maggie writes, any city that complained with holy self-righteousness because another city poached his team has no business acting holy when it tries to poach someone else's team. The fans rallied in Sacramento. They mounted a good campaign. I say good for them. If Seattle wants a new basketball team, create one. Well, that create one is the whole expansion argument, and that just sounds like it's dead for at least two or three years.
Well, at least this year coming up. And I understand the point of view of your listener, because I've always felt all along that expansion would be a better choice, because what we were doing under Sacramento was what was done unto us by Clay Bennett in Oklahoma City. A lot of people can't get around that poaching business.
Mm-hmm.
And as I got into the whole writing and covering of this, I saw, you know, Sacramento fans having the same anguish and pain about losing their team that Seattle experienced 5 years earlier. And somehow it got lost, I think, by some folks in Seattle who were so eager to have the Sonics back that we somehow were entitled to do this, even though there was a moral distaste for this, because we'd been had before, and I think that got lost.
So as opposed to turning the other cheek, it was due unto others.
Yeah, before they do unto you.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of our listeners say, you know, go Seahawks. We've got at least four people writing in, you know, that's okay, go Hawks. And, you know, when it's football season again, we can feel that way about it. Art Thiel, thanks for taking time to talk to us this morning.
My pleasure.
Art Thiel is a longtime Seattle sports writer. He's the founder and editor of Sports Press Northwest. You can hear him from time to time on KPLU and here on weekday on KUOW Seattle. Well, Seattleites may be bummed out, but as you heard, Sacramento fans are cheering that the uncertainty is over. Joining us now from Dallas is Ben Adler. He is the bureau chief for Capital Public Radio, which is located in Sacramento.
Well, it really was an afternoon of waiting and waiting and waiting for the dozen or so Sacramento and Seattle fans there, and certainly a lot of assorted media, but from both cities and, of course, national basketball reporters as well. So basically, first the Seattle group led by Chris Hansen presented to the owners, and then the Sacramento group led by Mayor Kevin Johnson presented. And after that, it was about 90 minutes of just the owners and league staff in a ballroom talking and waiting. At least on the outside. And finally, the meeting let out, and a couple of the better wired national and Sacramento reporters started to hear, looks good for Sacramento. And then out came Commissioner David Stern and made the big announcement.
He looked pretty weary. I watched that news conference. I was curious how big a role he actually played in Sacramento's bid.
I can't speak, you know, from personal knowledge, but for all intents and purposes, it certainly looks like he played the biggest of roles. And it was a role that he played in Sacramento's favor, at least from what the best guess is out there. And he said, you know, yesterday at his news conference, this was not about Seattle. He had warm words for the Hansen-Ballmer investor group that had reached a deal with the Sacramento Kings' current owners, the Malou family, to move the team to Seattle. But Commissioner said it wasn't about Seattle, it was about Sacramento. And he said, look, the edge goes to an incumbent city if that city does everything we ask it to, come up with a matching offer price to the Seattle original offer, which the Sacramento group did, come up with a solid investor group, which the Sacramento group did, and come up with a viable arena plan, which the Sacramento group did. So given all of that, the commissioner just felt there was no point in moving a team. And so given that, it appears that, you know, he worked in the background to help Mayor Johnson form the investor group and get the deal put together, and was pretty persuasive, I believe, in swaying many of the owners to certainly unanimously reject the first vote on the relocation committee, and then by a 22-8 vote yesterday, reject relocation at the full Board of Governors.
We still don't know what the purchase agreement will be finally, and if the Maloofs are going to go with the Ronadive Group offer. Did you speak with the Maloofs yesterday?
George Maloof did have a media avail just very briefly with reporters. In fact, it was a little humorous and a little sad. Reporters swarmed him, literally cornered him against a wall. With a door to a bellman's closet where his bags were. And at one point, he actually ducked inside, shut the door. We wondered if he was going away, but no, he came back out and he patiently answered every question. And he is leaving his options open. He is saying, you know, I respect the process set out by the league. I want to talk with the rest of my family, because he's only one of several family members who jointly own the Kings. And he did not rule out the deal that he, I guess, has with the Hansen investors for selling, I guess, what, 20% of the team, but keeping ownership, majority ownership for the Maloof family and staying in Sacramento. But he also said, you know, the mayor put together a good group, a really good investor group, and, you know, he is open to negotiating with the group led by Vivek Ranadive. And sure enough, after everyone was done talking to the media, a few minutes later, look who was meeting in one of the hotel restaurants. It was Kevin Johnson and George Maloof.
Wow. I know that the purchase money for the team was put in escrow. Is all the funding in place for a new arena?
So there's a city process that Sacramento needs to go through, but at this point they've done everything that they would need to do to keep the process on track.
I just one last question. In Seattle, it's no secret, not everybody wanted to put public money into a sports facility. Are there any opponents to this in Sacramento?
There are. In fact, there's a petition drive that's going to be started by a couple of lawyers to gather some signatures and put a referendum on the ballot on the city council's vote to approve the arena plan. Of course, it was not the official full arena plan at that point. It was just, you know, a conceptual plan. But there is certainly some resistance in Sacramento. The question is, how much resistance is that? Back in 2006, voters by about an 80% margin overwhelmingly rejected a push by the Maloofs and by the mayor at that time, Heather Fargo, and some business leaders for a sales tax to pay for a new arena. This would not be through a sales tax. It would be through some non-sales tax, non-general fund dollars, including parking revenues, future parking revenues at existing garages whose value would go up with an arena plopped right down in the middle of downtown, and also some properties that the city owns as well. So the folks opposed to this deal say that is a terrible use of taxpayer dollars. They say the money could be better spent on police, fire, parks, you name it. And they plan to, at least if they have the money to gather the signatures, put it on the ballot and see if voters want to reject it. And we'll see if things have changed from 2006, when the vote was also a big vote against the Maloof family, who had a couple of their brothers appear in a $600 or $6,000 hamburger ad for Carl's Jr. in the heat of the campaign as they were asking for public sales tax dollars to pay for their arena. It's very different right now. The Maloofs, of course, if the negotiation works out with the Rana Dive group, would be on their way out, and there'd be a local investor group with a commitment to Sacramento that has also come up with this arena plan that many people that I've talked to who aren't directly connected to basketball or aren't necessarily sports fans like what it would do, what they believe it would do in terms of revitalizing a very struggling part of Sacramento's downtown.
Ben Adler is bureau chief for Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. He joined us from his Dallas hotel room. We're going to be talking a little bit more about the Sonics in the next hour when King County Executive Dow Constantine joins us. This is Weekday.
It's 9:21. A visit to the studio of local hip-hop dance troupe Massive Monkeys in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Washington's Farmers and Ranchers. The Washington Grown Project celebrates family-owned and operated farms and ranches, which produce apples, wheat, and potatoes for Washington State and the world. Learn more at wagrown.com.
Join KUOW for a live broadcast of Garrison Keillor's A Prairie Home Companion on Saturday, June 15th at Chateau San Michel Winery in Woodinville. Learn more and find ticket information on the events page at KUOW.org.
57 degrees and mostly cloudy in Seattle. I'm Bernard Ouellette. The DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, is a tool used by clinicians to diagnose patients with mental disorders. Dr. Gary Greenberg says the DSM has some serious problems. He calls it an anthology of suffering. We'll find out why he says that and what he thinks should be done in about 15 minutes.
From KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Seattle's Storefronts Project is a collaboration between the city, private developers, and Shunpike, an art support organization. The idea is to revitalize vacant storefronts with temporary artist residencies. Most recently, the project has expanded into the Belltown neighborhood. The residencies are meant to last between 3 and 6 months, but sometimes a project just takes root, and that's the case with one of the January residencies, a hip-hop dance studio in Seattle's International District. It's run by one of the area's best-known dance crews, the award-winning Massive Monkeys. Their residency officially ended in April, but the Storefronts Project, Massive Monkeys, and the owner of the building where the residency was taking place agreed that their studio, called The Beacon, should be permanent. The problem is Massive Monkeys need to raise $30,000 to make some capital repairs on that space. So they launched a Kickstarter campaign. They're just a few thousand dollars short of their goal. Monday is the deadline. We decided that it would be good to revisit a trip that we took to the Beacon in February. We met with Massive Monkeys crew member Bryson Angeles, and we talked to him about the dream of opening a dance school.
The partner who I run the studio with, Ronald Kabang, actually brought this to my attention maybe 3 days before the deadline to get it submitted. So he brings it to me, and he's saying, well, we've been talking about doing the studio for some time now. Let's see what the chances of us getting this are. And in my head, I'm thinking, you know, we've applied for grants and we've tried to do these different things. This is just going to be 3 days of intensive work trying to submit this grant because I know how much was going to go into it. And more likely than not, we're not going to get it. We ended up going for it anyway. He did a lot of talking me into it. Like, yeah, well, it's worth a shot. You know, let's go for it. We submitted the grant, and then we waited a few months, and we heard back that out of, 400 submissions, we were one of, 70 or 80 organizations that got it. And, yeah, we were thrilled. But, you know, when they tell us, you're one of the organizations that actually get it, they say, you know, shortly after that, oh, but it's not guaranteed you're going to get a space. First, we have to find a space that will fit what your guys' idea of your project is. So it's kind of like, you got it, but you didn't all the way get it yet. Yeah.
So let me take you back to 99, and you're going to think I'm really dumb, but I need you to clarify, because I think of you, you're B-boys. Are there some girls in Massive Monkeys?
Yeah, there's we're most primarily B-boys, but there's two B-girls in our crew.
When I look at what you do, when I look at tapes, I think of it as something called breakdancing. Is that a term that you use to describe it?
Yeah, breakdancing is what I guess is most commonly known for our dance style or our dance form. Back when it was created, we were called B-boys and B-girls, break boys and break girls, because we would dance. We would go off and historically what they said is we would break to the break of the music, the part where a lot of the vocals and a lot of instruments drop out, and then it's just a drum break. I've heard different variations of this story and where the actual term comes from, but the technical term from the pioneers of this dance call us B-boys and B-girls, break boys and break girls, and we break. That's our dance style. When it became breakdancing was more of something that the media took, and they went with it, and they coined it this term breakdancing, which I don't, you know, I know it's not the proper term within our culture, but, you know, when we're talking about doing dance classes, for people to understand what we're talking about, we have to say they're breakdancing classes or break-in classes. So I guess all those terms at this point are all interchangeable.
There's ballet schools and tap schools and jazz hand schools, but I never think of this as something that comes out of a school.
This dance style was developed in the streets. This is something that a dance form that people latched onto who didn't have technical training, because in the 70s and at this time where this dance style came from in New York, there was no money in these families for them to send their kids to ballet schools. But it doesn't mean they don't like to dance, and it doesn't mean they don't like music. They are doing the same thing that other kids that had, more resources to them to be able to go and do these more structured things. But in that time, when the dance was being developed in the street, there was a foundation that was being developed in the street. There was a foundation of this dance, basic moves and movements that actually created this dance. And so when you talk about technical terms of there being ballet or tap or something, where there is a technical dance form, we have that in this dance form as well. And it was developed in the same way by innovative creative artists and dancers who create these moves. And so, yes, they're is a longer history of some of these other dance styles, but it's kind of a good thing. We are able to do that as well. And I want to go on to say that a lot of times it seems like there's some conflict between traditional dance styles and more street level dance styles, where, as in my opinion, being a B-boy, if at a younger age I would have been more open to taking jazz, ballet, acting classes, drama classes, all these different things than me as a performing artist, I would be a lot more developed, and my reach of the different job opportunities and opportunities to be an entertainer would be a lot broader. So in us creating the studio, we specialize in b-boying and breakdancing. We specialize in street dance. But as well, I want to offer these younger generation kids who are latching on to this street dance and this hip-hop dance, which is the most popular thing out there, it seems like to me, I want to also be able to encourage them and provide chances for them to do more traditional styles, to develop more well-rounded performing artists and dancers.
How did you learn?
I had a couple friends in middle school who had older brothers who were into breakdancing. They seen the movies, Beat Street Wild Style, these movies that were coming out back in those times, or even they were even a few years old at that time, but I seen what they were doing. I was always in the gymnastics, I was in the music and dance. They brought me up to Jefferson Community Center and to Mercer Middle School, where I kind of just jumped in their after school program. I acted like I was a student so I can come up there and learn. So I would go up there, I would do their after school program from my middle school, catch the bus, go there, and then straight after the after school program, we would go to Jefferson Community Center. And we were taught by a crew called DVS Crew. A major member in that crew is Carter McGlasson, also, aka Fever One. He's also a teacher here at the studio, and he was our mentor, one of our major mentors who basically gave us this path and this knowledge and the true experience and the essence of this dance form, gave it to us and let us run with it. And this is what we've been able to do with it. So us learning from people like Fever, that's what makes us passionate about sharing the same thing with the next generation and doing it on a bigger level than one day at a community center. We want to do this every day, all the time, and offer it regularly to any youth out there. So
show me like where you might start with a two-year-old. What would be the first thing besides having them run around, because that's what two-year-olds do, right?
We'll teach them some very, you know, basic dance moves. Maybe go down to the floor and just put their hands on the ground and maybe just do a shuffle. This obviously isn't b-boy footwork. B-boy footwork is more in a circle, and we'll get more intricate. But being able to teach a kid those type of moves, or a 2 to 6 year old, there are ones who can do it, yes, but mainly, we have to start them somewhere. So doing some tumbling and doing some stretching and doing some walking back and forth to music and doing some clapping their hands.
You mentioned earlier that there were set movements the same way that ballet or jazz have movements that have names. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if there's some that you could show me.
Well, we have something that's called the up rock, and that's mainly the dance that we do on top. So this is where we're finding our groove in the music. So if I'm hearing a beat, then before I even go down to the ground, I want to find my groove up top, and I want to dance up top in an up rock.
Is the movement coming from your core?
We want to definitely be balanced in our core, because that will allow us to put our limbs out in different directions. If our center of gravity is here, and I want to kick my leg out to the side, then if my center of gravity isn't centered in the core, then I'm going to fall the way that my leg is being kicked out.
So I'm doing an up rock. I'm hearing the beat, and it's coming out of sort of my hip, my center region. My arms are...
Fingers are snapping, hands are clapping. You want to carry the character in your face. You want to carry the character that you're feeling. If it's a music that sounds happy, then maybe we want to be happy and be funky with it. If it's something that sounds kind of more dark, then maybe we're going to be aggressive, and then we're going to go at our opponent, pointing at our opponent. And then when our groove is here, then we can go down to the ground and do our footwork moves. So
that's where I wish I had a video camera. Do you think it's something anybody can do?
Well, I think that a big thing that we want to share with people who are serious about becoming great dancers or great artists is the hard work and the dedication you put into it. Obviously, I've been doing it for 20 years, so I can just drop down to the floor and do that for you. But if there's somebody who's coming in and they have maybe a year of dance experience, we're not going to tell them, you're going to be a world-class breakdancer in 2 years. You're going to be a world-class b-boy or b-girl in 2 years. Like, we don't want to say that. What we do want to say to them is, come in, and if you're serious about it, we will share our experiences with you and help develop you to become as good as you can be with your individual personality, with your individual talent. And we're going to give you the tools where you can take that and put that hard work into it to get to that level that you want to be at.
You mentioned world class, and just turn around a second, because you've got posters from all kinds of, a lot of French posters here, mm-hmm. but these are places that Massive Monkeys have been.
What you see on the wall here is posters of events that we've won.
One thing that's really different about this kind of dance than jazz and ballet, those aren't competitions. They're not team against team, crew against crew.
Right.
It's the one thing that's really different about your art is that it's also sport in a way.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you pointed that out, because it is, I guess, what makes elements of hip-hop what they are. It's the battle. It's the competitive aspect that forces crews or individuals to try to be the best and one-up each other. And so with that direct competition, it's what really makes us elevate so fast. So yes.
Doing this, it's not that it takes it away from the street, but it is making it, you're kind of institutionalizing, in a way, something that is a street art form.
If we can bring some respect to this dance form, which sometimes, or this culture, which is hip-hop, if we could bring an element of respect and introduce people to really the true art forms behind what we're doing, then aside from us reaching the youth, that is another mission of ours, is to do that. Because sometimes it's misunderstood what we're about. You say street dance or you say street art form, and immediately people's minds go in this place where it's something street. It's rugged. It's maybe something that they don't want their kids involved in. But when you come in and you see it and you see that the community supports us and that we can share it directly with you in our studio on our dance floor, then that's a great thing. And if we are able to do that, then I think that's amazing and what we want to be doing.
Bryson Angeles is a member of the Seattle hip-hop crew Massive Monkeys. They're trying to raise $30,000 through Kickstarter by Monday to fund repairs to keep their dance studio, The Beacon, open and permanent. This is Weekday.
It's 9:34. Rethinking how mental illness is diagnosed. In a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Laird Norton Wealth Management, celebrating 75 years of King County Parks by establishing the King County Parks Foundation, devoted to strengthening families and connecting communities for generations to come. Information on contributing at OurParksOurFuture.org.
57 degrees in Seattle under a mostly cloudy sky. Forecast says it's going to turn partly sunny this afternoon with a chance of showers and a high of 66. Also, you might want to know that work crews are making repairs to the Ballard Bridge today. The Seattle Transportation Department says you should plan for delays.
Support for KUOW comes from the Champion Window and Sunroom Company, manufacturing and installing custom factory direct sunrooms since 1953. Champion's light-filled sunrooms provide outdoor beauty with indoor comfort year-round without bugs or rain. Visual tours available at getchampion.com/Seattle.
9:35. I'm Bernard Ouellette. A suicide bombing in Kabul has killed 15 people, including two American soldiers. More in the news at 10.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Next week, May 22nd, the American Psychiatric Association is scheduled to release the DSM-5, a new version of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. The first DSM was created with the intent of standardizing the diagnostic criteria for different mental conditions. But writer and psychotherapist Gary Greenberg argues that the process of creating the new DSM-5 was deeply flawed. He says it's going to encourage mental illness diagnoses and more dependence on drug treatments, among other things. Gary Greenberg's new book about the DSM-5 is called The Book of Woe, and he joins us in the studio. We're both smiling. I wanted to take a picture of a smiling person holding up the title, but thank you for being here.
That would create cognitive dissonance, and that's probably also going to be in the DSM.
Well, let's take a step back and explain a little further what the DSM in general is.
The DSM is a long, 1,000-page long, basically a dictionary of mental disorder. It lists 250 or so mental disorders that people could have and the criteria by which they can be known.
And what was the origins of this manual?
Well, originally it was just an attempt to count how many mentally ill people there were in the country so they could be represented in government. And that job, nobody knew how to do that. This is in the 19th century. Mentally ill people were hidden away in asylums and people's homes. And so they began to ask doctors who would be the most likely people to know this, especially the ones who ran the asylums. And over time, it evolved into a concerted effort to count and categorize for the benefit of public health bureaucrats and the census people and so on. And it became a function that sort of landed in the lap of the American Psychiatric Association. They didn't go out soliciting it, but it became theirs sort of by default, and they've been holding the franchise on it for more than 100 years.
Holding the franchise, meaning they own this.
Yes, it's eventually evolved into an intellectual property that the American Psychiatric Association owns and they control. They license the diagnostic criteria. If you have major depressive disorder, that diagnosis is owned by the APA. And if somebody wants to, for instance, write a book in which they reproduce the diagnostic criteria, they have to pay a licensing fee to the APA. It also allows them to exercise control as they have in recent year, over who can publish academically using at least using the provisional proposed criteria. Once the book comes out, they won't do that. But in the interim, people tried to do studies with the proposed criteria to see how they would work. And if those studies weren't sanctioned by the APA, they wouldn't give permission to use the criteria.
We're talking with Gary Greenberg. His latest book is called The Book of Woe, and it's about the development of this. I think this is actually the official fifth revision of the DSM, but there was another sort of...
There have been two interim
revisions,
one of which was substantial and one of which wasn't.
One of the... this is really probably the dumbest question ever, but aside from a medical degree, what is the difference between somebody who practices psychotherapy and psychiatry?
Well, the big difference is the medical degree, and that, of course, entitles doctors to, MDs to prescribe medication. More to the point, it's a whole different kind of training. And increasingly, that training is around psychopharmacology. And increasingly, the economics of healthcare demand that psychiatrists not conduct therapy unless they want to not get paid through insurance and spend their time, like most doctors, in 10 or 12 or 8-minute blocks doing medication management.
In the origins of categorizing mental illnesses, what is the role that science itself played as opposed to, and mostly because this has been revised so much, it leads you to think an appendectomy is diagnosable. Mm-hmm. You have a pain, you go to a doctor and they poke and they say, you know.
Well, what happens if you have appendicitis is you have the pain, the doctor pokes, and says, I think maybe you have appendicitis, and they take a picture. They have you drink a radioactive fluid that is then take a CAT scan and look at your belly and can see an inflamed appendix. And that actually is the model of diagnosis that we expect from doctors. That is, that they'll find the biochemical cause of our suffering.
And how does that relate to this? Well, I'm holding it up. This is not the DSM, but let's pretend I'm holding the DSM up.
It relates in the sense that that's the aspiration of the DSM. The DSM, psychiatry would like to have a diagnostic system that is based on what we normally think of as science, that is to say, based on biochemical findings. The problem is that we don't understand the brain anywhere near well enough. We don't understand it as well as we understand the appendix or the lungs or the heart. And so while much of medicine has diseases that don't have biochemical findings, migraine would be an example, in psychiatry, none of them do. And that's the big difference between psychiatry and the rest of medicine.
None of them have?
No, there's no... The DSM-5, just like the predecessors, will not have any diagnoses with lab tests or tissue cultures. They had the opportunity to have one. It was going to be called melancholia, a form of depression that had some very significant lab findings associated with it and has been known for many years. But they decided they didn't want it because, to put it bluntly, they thought it would make the rest of the book look bad.
I'm sure that they wouldn't agree with the way you characterize that.
Well, you're probably right, although I have the memos, and it says that you understand the problem with this. We think you're correct, but it would be the only diagnosis in the DSM that would have this lab test, and they don't go on and say, therefore it would make the rest of it look bad, but what other conclusion is there?
So this is the seventh revision, the fifth official version. Who actually made the revisions to the DSM-5?
There's 150 people or so who are on different committees, and each committee does its own assessment of a certain area of the DSM, and then they submit it to another committee, which submits it to another committee.
And since the American Psychiatric Association owns it, are these all psychiatrists?
No. There was an effort to recruit non-psychiatrists and also an effort to recruit people from around the world, but by and large, they're American white men who make the DSM.
And is that who uses the DSM?
Everybody uses the DSM. I mean, there's 500,000 or more mental health clinicians out there. I'm one of them that if they want to participate in the insurance system has to use the DSM, at least to the extent that they need the codes to put on the bills to get the insurance reimbursement. And that, by and large, is the largest use of the DSM.
So if somebody comes to you as a psychotherapist, you look things up in this book?
Well, if somebody comes to me...
You don't use it.
What happens is that I say, yes, I can help you collect for your insurance company. I don't participate in any of these panels, but I'll give you the paperwork. But first, let's figure out what mental illness you have. And that usually brings people up short. In the kind of practice I have, they say, well, hey, I'm not mentally ill. Well, yes, you have to be if you're going to use your insurance. It's medical insurance. And so we often have a discussion about which diagnosis we'll use and what the implications are and how it might affect your ability to get life insurance and all of that. And sometimes they'll say, yeah, go ahead, and I'll give them a diagnosis. And sometimes they don't. And the upshot of that is I make less money.
So then part of the problem is the relationship that has developed with how we pay for health care in this country, and in addition to the book.
Absolutely. The DSM is would not happen in the way that it does if it weren't for the way we pay for health care in this country, and also for the fact that psychotherapy has sort of gotten in bed with medicine, which it didn't have to do. And as a result, those of us who want to provide the service or get the service tend to enter into that system. It's not really necessary.
So why was that getting into bed? Why did that happen?
It happened because it happened in 1926 when the New York Psychoanalytic Institute basically said, nobody can practice psychoanalysis who isn't a psychiatrist. And I don't think they did it to, you know, get into the insurance system, because that wasn't developed.
Right.
But it was clear that they wanted to medicalize the practice of therapy and to corner the market.
Is that also a way to legitimize in a world that's increasingly based on having, you know, hard evidence, I suppose?
Yes, it was exactly that. The idea was, this is the most credible. It's all about confidence building, right? If you can claim that you're a doctor and that you have medical science behind you, then people will believe you. And so it was clearly an attempt to latch on to that very powerful force. The problem is, it's purely rhetorical. It's purely aspirational. There is no connection that we have found yet between the kinds of things that underlie appendicitis and the kinds of things that underlie depression. We just haven't found them yet.
We're talking with Gary Greenberg. His book is called The Book of Woe, The DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry, and he's going to be speaking this evening at Seattle Town Hall. This is the fifth book. This is the book you are writing about, DSM-5, not DSM-4. Is there a measurable gap in credibility in what's in the DSM-5 as opposed to 4?
Actually, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think that from that point of view, they're pretty much the same. In fact, I think the two books are going to be much more similar than the criticism that's accompanied this last couple years of the process would indicate. I don't see that this DSM-5 is going to increase the overall prevalence of mental illness. That DSM-4 didn't, even though it introduced the categories of Asperger's disorder and bipolar 2 disorder, the overall prevalence of mental disorder didn't increase.
Well, let's talk about Asperger's, because that's not, as I understand it, that's been taken out of the DSM.
Asperger's is going to die its unnatural death next week.
So you mentioned the 100 or so folks who sit around.
Yeah,
who are these guys who make these decisions?
Well, you know, they're people who have a very refined notion of diagnosis, and they're very concerned with these questions of sorting. You know, it's a taxonomy. And the people who are attracted to the field are people who are really interested in categorization. And sometimes they get so involved in their silo, as we say these days, that they don't really get the big picture. So when they decided to remove Asperger's from the DSM, which is a technical issue that at one level anyway, they were surprised when thousands of people with Asperger's disorder wrote in onto the website to complain that they were taking away their identity. They were surprised because it hadn't occurred to them that the diagnosis had created an identity. Now, you have to be really living inside an insulated environment not to have known that.
Well, it's, one of those critics is Temple Grandin, who's written widely about autism, which she has herself. And her latest book, we're going to be talking to her on Monday, this is why it's in my head, talking about the new field of brain science, because it is a very new field, and what that tells about the autistic brain. And she mentioned in passing, because I was reading both these books, that Asperger's was going to be removed. And she talked initially about how that was, while she disapproved of this removal, that it was sort of all of it as a nebulous diagnosis, and that at some point, weird, geeky people were just weird, geeky people, and perhaps many of them live in Silicon Valley and develop code for the computers that I'm looking at. And now they have a label that they can put to their weird geekiness. And I guess the question I have has to do with mental illness, or it's not even called mental illness in the DSM-5. It's called a mental disorder, right? Mm-hmm. Illness isn't the correct word. So there isn't really a definition when we say mental illness.
It's... No. Despite the DSM itself being 60-some-odd years old, they've never managed to define mental disorder. Now, that's if you think about it, trying to define disease is really difficult. We think of a disease as a suffering that's caused by a biochemical pathogen. But as I said earlier, that's not necessarily a good definition. How I would define disease and how I think a lot of DSM people define it, a disease is a form of suffering that we as a society decide to devote resources to relieving. And one of the ways we do that is by saying, well, your problem is physical. The DSM can't do that. But what it can do is it can say, okay, this group of people has, we're going to name the disorder. Mm. And by naming it, we're going to create the grounds for you to get those resources.
So depression, for example, people used to feel depressed. Now they have depression.
Exactly.
When was depression made a disease?
Well, the major depression as we know it was more or less created in 1980 with the DSM-3. I mean, always there's been depression, I mean, for thousands of years. But the way it is today came to us in about 1980.
1952 was the first DSM,
yes,
right?
Yes, the first one.
Homosexuality was a disease.
It was a disease until 1973, and then it was removed because activists insisted that it be removed. They basically paralyzed the APA for a number of years at their meetings. They protested, and finally a group of gay psychiatrists came out literally and said, we're gay. So how are you saying we're diseased? And they voted to take it out. Now, I think that was a good decision, but voting is not usually how science is conducted.
This is an interesting distinction because I'm thinking of things like, you know, scarlet fever or tuberculosis. I mean, you don't remove those, you have those. And yet people come to you because they're suffering. Mm-hmm. They clearly have anguish of some sort. Sometimes it does manifest itself in, you know, physical symptoms. And so I guess I'm wondering, the problem that you have really is the pharmacology, the treating it with a drug portion, the naming to treat with a drug, not the fact that there is suffering that is not related to a specific and biologically identifiable disease.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you know, there's not a real solid connection between diagnosis and treatment. The DSM is explicitly not a treatment manual. And think about it. You know, people take antidepressants to treat anxiety problems. They take antipsychotics to treat depression problems. They take anti-anxiety to treat psychotic problems. So there's no correlation there. And actually, most of the prescriptions for antidepressants are written in the absence of a psychiatric diagnosis. 3/4 of them.
Really?
Yeah, and most of them are written by family doctors who hear a person's complaints and think about them in exactly the same way as they think about their headaches or whatever else, and they know there's this drug out there, and they write a prescription.
Do the drugs do any good?
Sometimes. You know, the problem is that the DSM has directed research efforts in such a way as to make us all, researchers, look for effects on a disease, on disorders that don't really exist. Hmm. So what you end up with is a disconnect between, on the one hand, what the drugs might be doing, and on the other hand, what you can look for. Trying to understand what antidepressants do by researching depression is sort of like trying to find sawdust with a magnet. They're not really connected. But in order to get the drug approved, the FDA requires the disease label. In order to do the research, the NIH wants the money, wants you to show that it's tied to a diagnosis.
Interesting. How do you think that the burgeoning field of brain science is going to affect both the DSM and the study of things like depression?
Well, the National Institute of Mental Health is hoping that the field of brain science is going to allow them to put mental disorder onto the same footing as the rest of illness. However, I'm somewhat doubtful. I'm doubtful for two reasons. One of them, the brain is the most complex object in the universe that we know of. It's got 100 billion neurons. Each can make 1,000 connections. You do the math. And we're nowhere near. I mean, we're in the dark ages of understanding it. But the second issue, which is more substantial, is that it's not as simple as finding, you know, what brain stuff underlies who we are. When we start to learn about these things, it changes who we are. We start to think of ourselves differently. This has happened before in history. that we've come to think of ourselves as people whose lives individually have meaning and so on. That didn't exist 600 or 800 years ago. Mm. So it could change us. It could change us into the people of the molecule. I'm not 100% sure that's a great idea. Sometimes I feel like when I say that, I feel like the Pope talking about Galileo. But nonetheless, it ought to be at least approached cautiously.
You mentioned the National Institutes of Mental Health, one of the many groups that has disavowed the DSM-5, and it made me wonder whether the DSM-4 was as controversial as this fifth.
Well, the head of the DSM-4, who came out against the DSM-5 in sort of a scorched earth campaign, and which I write about a lot in the book, was very careful not to allow this to happen. It was his primary goal was to keep this from being controversial. But the idea that he had, and the reason was because he knew if the controversy was out there, it would turn into the kind of circus that he himself has turned it into with the DSM-5. And I would point out that even though he did that, the few new disorders he let in were Asperger's disorder, bipolar 2, they started epidemics. So he was right, but even he couldn't stop it. The problem is when you have expert consensus as opposed to science running the show, this is what's going to happen. People disagree, and then the disagreements get put under amber, and then you come to a new revision, and you open them up to air, and they proliferate.
We're talking about all this brouhaha I mentioned in introducing you. This book hasn't even officially been released. It doesn't come out till next week. So how can this all be so much of a circus, as you call it?
Well, because, you know, there's a lot of things that come together here. One of them is the American suspicion of the elite. People don't like the idea that there's a bunch of psychiatrists out there telling them what's wrong with them, for starters. And so there's a lot of interest there. And then you add to it the fact that there's some of the absurdities of the DSM, calling grieving a mental disorder, are such easy targets that for social commentators, it's like shooting fish in a barrel. And it especially for people who worry about the loss of agency, who worry about our loss of moral direction, it becomes a very tempting target and it creates the circus.
So what's the alternative to the DSM?
I don't know that there is one. People ask me that question and I say, how would I know? I mean, it's not my job. However, I would point out a couple of things. First of all the distinctions in the DSM are arbitrary. That's not to say they're bad, but they're arbitrary, as many distinctions are. And the one arbitrary distinction that isn't made in the DSM is the one between severe mental illness and the rest of it, between the worried well and the severely mentally ill. They should make that distinction. And the DSM grew out of a set of 21 diagnoses. Go back to a much smaller set of diagnoses for people who might really have a medical illness. We don't know that yet. Mm. Psychiatry hasn't even been able to tell us that. But go back to that and focus the effort and the energy and the resources on those people, and psychiatry would have to contract, but that might not be such a terrible thing.
Dr. Gary Greenberg's a writer and a psychotherapist, and his latest book about the DSM-5 and the origins of it is called The Book of Woe, The DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry. Gary Greenberg's going to be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at Seattle's Town Hall. Thanks for coming in today.
Oh, I'm glad to have been here.
This is KUOW. And now, the sound of the day. Very, very close, Mike. That's Sadie, our listener, Chris's 6-year-old cat. After a busy night, Sadie's curled up on the couch and she fell into a deep sleep. So I guess that's cat snoring?
Cat. That's just silly sounding.
Silly sounding cat. What interesting sounds are you listening to? Could be your snoring cat. Could be anything. Yesterday it was lovely sheep. Record 30 seconds of the sound and send it to us along with the story behind your sound. Email your audio file to weekday@kuow.org and include sound of the day in the subject line. And stay with us in the next hour. King County Executive Dow Constantine will be here and we're going to talk more about the would-be sonics.
It's 9:59. What will Washington State's legal marijuana industry look like? We should learn something about that today. KUOW's Lisa Brooks tells us more in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from HopeLink, whose End Summer Hunger project provides vital nutritional needs for youths during summer vacation when school programs are not available. Information about school or individual involvement in End Summer Hunger is on the web at hope-link.org.
Later today, we're talking about unpaid internships. Are they a good thing? Some people think they should be banned. We're going to take up the ethics of unpaid internships today at noon, and we'd love to hear what you think. Are you or have you ever been an unpaid intern? Do you think the U.S. should ban unpaid internships? Why or why not? Give us a call, 206-221-3663, 206-221-3663. Are unpaid internships exploiting low-skill workers? Or are they valuable opportunities? We're going to take that up today at noon.
Support for KUOW comes from Alaska USA Federal Credit Union. For over three generations, Alaska USA members have shared the goal of helping each other get places worth going with savings accounts, loans, investments, insurance policies, and more. On the web at alaskausa.org.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.